Some time ago, some friends and I were making a trip up to Minnesota to go fishing. And to go from Mississippi to Minnesota is quite a trip.
Yeah.
It's like a day's journey, right? And for whatever reason, I'm the first guy driving and I get the idea that I just want to go, right? I don't want to give up my seat. I want to see how far can I make this? And I'm not experienced like you Wyoming drivers, right? Like we make this trip once in a blue moon. So this is not, you know, this is something that's a big deal for me. And all my friends, they end up taking a nap because eventually I'm going to get tired and need to take a nap too. And we stop at a gas station. They take a nap. My navigator sitting in my side seat kind of points me in the right direction. Look for this sign and get going. And I get going. And I think I'm doing all right. Right? Until a few hours later when my navigator wakes up. And he looks up and he says, "This isn't where we're supposed to be." And we're on our way to Chicago. And apparently the way, you know, there are two roads that go side by side that met all the checkpoints along the way that they gave me. But at some point or other, the road that I was on just kind of veered a little bit off. And we ended up in the wrong location. We weren't going where we were supposed to. And I find that for many of us, our lives, the perception of our lives, we kind of, it's based on the perception of our progress, right? Am I in the place that I thought I would be at this age? Am I in the place that I should be by now? Have I accomplished the things that I thought I would? Am I happy? Am I successful? Are my dreams more real today? But what about when your future kind of isn't turning out how you planned? What about when your dreams begin to unravel? What about when it all falls down? What about when you're faced with the loss of a career or the loss of a spouse or the loss of a child? And you look up and you say, you know, this isn't where I'm supposed to be. This isn't how life was supposed to go for me. This isn't how I planned. Where was God? And why would God allow this to happen? Was he not powerful enough to stop it? Did he not want to stop it? What does God want me to do now? I thought this was the direction he had me going. What am I supposed to do now? None of these questions are new. None of these questions are unique to us individually. These are all questions that we can find in each of those sitting in the seats beside you. They're questions that we find being asked in the text today, most likely by the young exiles from Judah. When the nation of Israel was first mentioned in the story, we were given their calling in Genesis chapter 12 in the first three verses. They're supposed to be God's chosen vehicle to bring blessing to all the families of the earth. The seed of the woman, the Messiah, we know him as Jesus on this side of the cross. You know, he was supposed to come forth from the nation and bless the world. When the nation of Israel was multiplied and delivered from Egypt, we were given Israel's commission, the Great Commission of Israel. In Exodus chapter 19, verse 5 and 6, we're told they were to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Okay? In the economy of God, Israel was supposed to represent God before the nations. They were supposed to rule over the nations and bless the nations with the revelation of the one true God and the way in which he was going to save them through the giving of his Son. But now, in our progression of the story, the nation is not a nation anymore. There is no Israel. There is no Judah. Where was God? And why would God allow this? Isn't this the direction that the story's been going? Did he not want to stop it? Was he not powerful enough to stop it when Nebuchadnezzar came? Three times. Doesn't he know that these are his people who he delivered from Egypt? What does he expect them to do now that they're in Babylon? These are just a few of the questions hanging in the air as we pick up our story in the book of Daniel today. So if you'll turn with me to Daniel chapter 1. Now, some of the best known Bible stories are found in the book of Daniel. I certainly think of Daniel in the lion's den. I think of the fiery furnace. I think of the writing on the wall. Some of the most incredible prophecies are also found in Daniel. I think of Nebuchadnezzar's statue. I think of the four beasts. I think of the 70 weeks. Some theologians call Daniel the key to prophecy. In his Olivet Discourse, Jesus will say, "When you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel," and then Matthew makes a little aside, a little parenthetical note. He says, "Let the reader understand," meaning if you haven't read the book of Matthew and you don't know what Jesus is talking about right now, stop. Go no further. Take a break. Go read Daniel and then come back when you understand it. Because otherwise none of this will make any sense to you. So if you haven't worked through Daniel, if you've never kind of been through this book, if the prophecy has kind of been this foggy, you know, you're a pan-millennialist, just how everything's pan out, that's going to be okay for you. Hopefully our study in Daniel will be exciting and enlightening for you. And if you've been through it before, hopefully it will help you become more ingrained in what you already know. As we study through this book, we're going to find that Daniel is concerned with two things. The first is going to be the end time. You know, how is God going to fulfill His promises now that the nation is outside the land? The second is the meantime. How should we live while we wait for God to fulfill His promises? So the end time, how He's going to fulfill His promises, and the meantime, what should we do while we wait for Him to fulfill His promises? Now look at Daniel chapter 1. We're going to just jump right in the first chapter, first verse. "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." Now, we've been away from 2 Kings for just a little bit, so let me refresh your memory. You might remember that the last five kings of Judah were Josiah. Okay, he reigned for a little bit, like 31 years. He's the one, remember when Pharaoh Necho was going up against Assyria? And Josiah said, "Well, I'm going to put a stop to that." He said, "Don't do that. All right, God told me to do this. You better not come interfere." And he gets the bright idea to dress up like a soldier and ends up dying in battle. That was Josiah. After him, Jehoahaz. Okay, when he died, Jehoahaz became the ruler over Judah. Well, Pharaoh Necho just came right down to Judah after that and took him along with him. He took him into exile. So he only reigned like 3 months. After that, we have Jehoiakim, the fellow in our text. He was put on the throne by Pharaoh. So when Pharaoh comes and he takes one away, well, somebody has to fill his spot. It's going to be Jehoiakim. Okay? And he rules for about 11 years. And in that time, Babylon becomes the big kid on the playground. And he wipes out Pharaoh. And Assyria is not a threat anymore. And Nineveh is not a threat anymore. And he comes to make Judah his vassal. He's going to come over to Judah. And Jehoiakim starts off with a good sense to say, "Okay, okay." But after a while, he rebels. The Jewish people can be stubborn, we'll find out. And when he rebels, Nebuchadnezzar comes back. Okay, he's died by the time he makes it back. But his son's there, Jehoiachin. He has to pick up the tab. He only rules for about 3 months. And when Nebuchadnezzar shows up, he takes him with him. Okay, the first time Nebuchadnezzar came, he took a few guys with him. The second time he came, he took away 10,000 people that were living in Jerusalem. And then he sets the fifth king, the last king, on the throne named Zedekiah. He says, "All right, you rule." And he leaves. Zedekiah rules for about 11 years, but the Jewish people can be very stubborn, and he rebels again. And then Nebuchadnezzar comes right back, and this time he kills a third of the people that are left. He takes a third of the people that are left captive and leaves a third of the people left in the land, the poorest of the poor. Okay, and that last time that he comes through, he destroys Jerusalem. I mean, he leaves the temple, he leaves the Jerusalem walls just in a little ash heap. There's not really a city left anymore. Okay. Those are the last five kings. Daniel is going to be written to the exiles. They're going to receive this after all this has happened, after Jerusalem has been destroyed. They're looking at it on that side. But Daniel is going to come into our text. He's going to come into the scene under the reign of Jehoiakim. That's in the year 605. It is Nebuchadnezzar's first pass through. And the question that they're asking is, where was God? Where was God when Nebuchadnezzar came through, and why on earth would he allow this? We're supposed to be his people. Look at verse 2. Daniel tells us right off the bat, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Where was God? Daniel says, oh, he was there. He was there during the siege. In fact, he was the one who gave the king of Judah into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. He was fighting against us, in case you didn't notice. Why would God do such a thing to his own people? Now, as we were moving towards the end of the book of 2 Kings, you know, we saw all those prophets are popping up and they're saying, look, you guys better turn this thing around or you're going off the tracks. Daniel will tell, just listen, this is chapter 9. He's going to get real specific. He won't say in the first chapter, but in chapter 9, he's going to say this. Listen to this. 9:11. Indeed, all Israel has transgressed your law and turned aside, not obeying your voice. So the curse has been poured out on us, along with the oath which was written in the law of Moses, the servant of God. For we have sinned against him. Thus he has confirmed his words, which he had spoken against us and against our rulers who ruled us, to bring on us great calamity. For under the whole heaven there has not been done anything like what was done to Jerusalem. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this calamity has come on us, yet we have not sought the favor of the Lord our God by turning from our iniquity and giving attention to your truth. Therefore the Lord has kept the calamity in store and brought it on us. For the Lord our God is righteous with respect to all his deeds which he has done, but we have not obeyed his voice. Covenant unfaithfulness has brought covenant judgment upon the nation. Okay? Daniel says, it's all been laid out plainly in our book of the law. We knew this was coming, but we wouldn't turn back. We just ran faster towards that cliff, and now it's come upon us. Look back to chapter 1. So Nebuchadnezzar gets the idea. He takes the people, he takes the vessels of the temple, and he puts it in the house of his God, which is a brilliant idea, right? Taking God's stuff from his temple and putting it in a pagan temple with pagan gods is like taking a Siamese fighting fish and putting it in your aquarium. Okay? God does not play well with other gods. The Philistines found this out, right? When they tried to take the ark and they go put the ark in the house of their gods, and their gods start falling apart, and they said, well, we got to find some way to get rid of this thing. And they start sending it around, and it's like a weapon of mass destruction everywhere it goes. It's just whooping everybody, and then finally makes its way back to Israel. The Lord says, where you guys been? You know, I've been back there fighting the Philistines. Nebuchadnezzar is going to drop the utensils. They're going to pop up in chapter 5. For now, he's going to stash them in the treasuries of his God. And we're going to find, before Babylon took Judah into exile, the southern kingdom, Assyria took the northern kingdom into exile, right? Now, Assyria had their own kind of strategy when it came to attacking a nation. They would come in, it was kind of like Desert Storm, shock and awe. They come and they level the first couple cities they come to, wipe out everybody in hopes of, you know, causing the people to fear and cause them to submit quickly. Say, we don't want to fight. You know, we'll submit. And when the people submitted, they would take half the population, roughly, and they would exile them, deport them somewhere. Now, then they'd have a problem, right? Because you can't work the crops in the land. They won't be able to get their taxes. They won't be able to get their tribute if you don't have enough people in the land to work. So what they'll do is they'll take people from other lands they've conquered, and they'll move it in to fill in that 50% hole. Okay? This is what happened in the northern kingdom. So whenever we come to the New Testament and we're looking at the people in the north, what are they called? They're not called Israel anymore, are they? Samaritans, right? They're the half-Jews. Because, you know, Samaria is in the north. This new population of people has come and they've settled with the Jews, and the Jews have begun to intermarry with them, so now they're kind of half-Jews and they're looked down upon. Those are the Samaritans. Babylon doesn't do that. Babylon has an entirely different policy when it comes to attacking other nations.
They attack Judah, and who do they take? Look at verse 3. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles. They take their leaders. They come in and they just remove the leadership from a population, and then they're going to bring in some of their leaders, put their people in place, because it's harder for people to revolt when you don't have leaders. At least in theory. Again, the Jews continued to revolt time and again. They had to keep coming back and stomp the place again. But in theory, if we just remove the leaders, the best of the land, we'll be able to keep all the structures, the economic structures in place. We can get tribute, we can get taxes. We don't have to fool with all that. But the people they take, okay, this is the best and the brightest in the land. You don't want to just wipe them out. No, what Babylon does is they want to take them and integrate them into Babylon. Okay, they want to increase their culture, their society, by taking the best and brightest, deporting them, putting them in Babylon, training them, and then kind of brainwashing them into Babylon society and cause them to serve them. So that's what they're doing here. They're going to take the best. They're going to take the brightest. We find that, you know, there's recorded, the trek is recorded in various places like Psalms, where we find these exiles weeping by the rivers in Babylon, and the Babylonians are wanting them to sing the songs of Jerusalem. They're saying, we can't sing the songs of our city that's been destroyed. They make it to Babylon, and they were, if you'll notice it, verse 4. Youths, young men who are in good shape, who are good looking, who are intelligent, who show an aptitude for every kind of learning. You think these guys had plans for their lives? Goals? Dreams? They had every reason to believe that they would accomplish whatever they set their mind to, and now, due to something that's going on in the background, no fault of these youths, their dreams are shot. They're never going to see their families again. They're never going to see Jerusalem again. They're never going to see their homes again. The closest that they'll ever get to the temple are the vessels that's being carried along with them to be stored in Babylon in the house of the pagan gods. These young men are taken, and they're assimilated into Babylon. And notice it, verse 6. And among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. And to Daniel he assigned the name of Belshazzar. And to Hananiah, Shadrach. And to Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. So they're taken. They go through Babylonian brainwashing. What they're going to do is they're going to give them education and a new diet and a new role in politics. They're going to change their names. Why? I mean, you can think of a variety of normal, practical reasons. I mean, if you have ever talked to a foreign exchange student, they normally have an English name, right? Because we can't really understand the names from where they come from. I got a friend of mine in Dallas. His Chinese name is Wrong. Like, you're not right, you're wrong. But everybody calls him Eddie. They have English names they're given because we can understand that. It's easier to work with. But that's not all. You'll find that Daniel and his friends, their names are all attached to God, their God, Yahweh. So if you look at the end of the names, you'll see either El, you know, Daniel, or Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. The Yah or the El has to do with their God, and their names are changed to reflect pagan gods. So Daniel has to do with my judge is the Lord, my judge is God. But it's changed to Belshazzar, which is Baal, protect the king. But what's interesting about that, you'll notice the T-E, Belshazzar. There's going to be a king that'll pop up later in our story named Belshazzar. We think the T-E was actually added to mean not or can't. Like Baal can't protect the king, like Daniel as the author is saying, just so you guys know, you know, this is my little jab at you. But nonetheless, all the names, we're not sure exactly what the construction makes, but it all has their pagan gods built into these names. So not only are they assimilating there and they're thinking, they're taking even their names, they're assigning, they're setting upon them this Babylonian brainwash system. Now verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind. He would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. And he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now, in the grand scheme of things, you know, in the scheme of all that's going on, the question as to whether Daniel is going to eat this food, basically it seems that he's trying to keep kosher. He doesn't want to defile himself. So, seemingly, some of the food is either going to be non-sanctioned food or it's going to be food that was sacrificed to a pagan god. For whatever reason, Daniel just says, look, by participating in this, I'm going to defile myself. I'm breaking the law. Don't want to do that. He's going to seek a way not to do it. And in the grand scheme of everything that's going on, the question of whether Daniel is able to keep kosher appears like a minor issue to me on the outset. I mean, these guys are being deported, secularized, their names are changed. By the time the book goes out, the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed. There's no king in Judah. So against all that's going on, it's like, but the kosher thing is what we're talking about here. It's like if Grandma's house is burning down and we're worried about whether Junior stole a cookie on the way out or not. So, you know. But then I wonder, if it's so minor, why is it included? Why is this event going to be the focus of Daniel chapter 1? And I think, if Daniel hadn't made this decision, would there be a Daniel chapter 2? Would there be a Daniel chapter 3 if he had not made the decision not to defile himself? If Daniel and his friends hadn't resolved to be faithful in this instance, would they have been faithful in the later stories when their lives are on the line, when they're asked to bow down before an idol? Would they have been faithful then? For most of us, in the 80 or so years that we have to walk the face of the earth, we're only going to have a few defining moments in our lives. But the decisions that we make in those defining moments are not going to be made in that instant. They're made over a lifetime. They're going to be the decisions that you've made over and over and over again. So that when the time comes, the decision has already been predetermined for you. It's been predetermined. It is who you are because it's who you've chosen to be consistently your entire life. Daniel chooses to be faithful. He determines not to defile himself. He says, look, I don't care what everybody else here in Babylon is doing. I don't care if everyone in Babylon is watching Game of Thrones. I'm not watching it. I'm not eating this pork. I'm not doing this thing. I'm not defiling myself. Change my name. I don't care what you call me. You cannot affect my identity. Okay? You can't get to it. And he makes the idea not to defile himself. Now, how does he go about it? Well, he doesn't start a riot. He doesn't start vandalizing Babylon. He doesn't try to burn the place down. He seeks permission to abstain. Okay? And we find in verse 9, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And I wonder, you know, how did he do that? You know, is it like a Jedi mind trick? You know, this is not the Hebrew slave that you're looking for kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, God could do that, but he also often uses means, does he not? I mean, how often in the story do you see just a pow? I mean, we see it, but often he's working in and through the lives of these individuals. He gave Daniel favor and compassion, possibly through the interactions that Daniel had the opportunity to work with this person who was over him. Possibly through opportunities that Daniel could have chosen to be rebellious, could have chosen to be a jerk. Instead, he doesn't do that. Instead, he may be working in and through means. Now, despite that, we find, verse 10, the commander of the officials says to Daniel, "Look, I'm afraid of my lord the king who's appointed your food and your drink. Why should he see your face looking more haggard than the use of your own age? You know, then you'd make me forfeit my head to the king." He says, he's just not willing to go out on a limb for Daniel. He doesn't say no. It's more of a, "Look, I can't help you." And we're going to find as we progress through the story, he has really good precedent for this. I think it's in the very next chapter that the king gets angry and decides to kill all the wise men in Babylon because he doesn't like what they're saying. So in an instant, if you're in Babylon, you know, this isn't, you don't have to go through any kind of judiciary committee. If the king wants you dead, you're dead. So he says, "I can't disobey this order from the king because I don't think it'll affect you well. He'll find out and then I'll die." But what Daniel does, as you'll notice, he takes the information to his subordinate, the person who's right above Daniel, the person who's serving Daniel the plate. He takes it to this overseer and he says, "Look, let's have a test. Serve me just vegetables for 10 days. We'll see how this thing plays out, okay? If it affects me negatively, if I end up looking haggard, fine. I'll drink the wine, I'll eat the food, whatever. Okay, test me." And he gets the time. And he takes the test. Notice this, verse 12. "Please test your servants, let our appearance be observed." 13. He listens. And at the end, verse 15, of 10 days, their appearance seemed better than and they were fatter than all the youths that had been eating the king's choice food. Have you heard of the Daniel fast? Yeah? Or Rick Warren's the Daniel plan? You know that one? You've done it? His similar ideas where they look at this and they say, "What can we gain from the looking at his dietary laws? You know, is it going to affect us in some biblical secret positive way?" When I look at the Daniel diet, you know, I think a lot about Jacob's animal husbandry. Okay? I don't think any of you farmers have been trying that, have you? Going, getting some sticks, putting them down, stripping them, little lines in them, and dancing around and seeing if you can get the sheep to come out spotted or to come out plain. When I look at this diet, I think a lot of that. You know, I think, you know, it's not about the food. It's not about the food. And the chapter is not about the man, Daniel, who's eating the food. It's about the God who's behind it. It's about the God who is still working in and through this disobedient people. It's the God who refuses to let them go because he's chosen them from among all the nations, through whom he's going to bring his son. It's about the God. So the narrator is not trying to get his audience to mimic Daniel's diet, but to mimic his faithfulness in spite of the circumstances. Exile. And for us, it means that we want to imitate that faithfulness in spite of our circumstances. Okay? To learn the secret of being content in whatever situation. Okay? We think we've taken a wrong turn. I don't know why I've ended up here, but I can still be faithful. God knows why. God knows what's going on. God knows what's going on in Daniel's life. And it's for us to gain the courage to be obedient despite the consequences. Obedient despite what we think might happen. Again, I wonder, you know, how did God, if you look down, so despite the fact that they're eating vegetables, they're getting fatter, and verse 17, these four youths, as for them, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And I say, well, how did that happen? You know, is it the Matrix? Are we downloading information? I know Kung Fu. Or are they actually having to put effort in, and the Lord is blessing their effort and working in and through them to give them knowledge and wisdom better than all their contemporaries? I don't know. But it doesn't matter. Nonetheless, we see God working in and through, and Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and all kinds of dreams. And I'm starting to think that this character sounds a lot like another character that we've covered. Do we know another young man who found himself enslaved and taken from home? Yeah. Another handsome young man who found favor in the eyes of his master? Another man who God gave the ability to understand visions and all kinds of dreams? We've talked about this before. History does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Okay? God's moving in that direction, and he's going to bring in his
kingdom. Okay? He's not bringing it. He's trying to drag this people along to bring in his kingdom. The first time when he was going through to drag them into their land, they came up to that Kadesh Barnea incident. First generation didn't want to go. All right. You go run out in the wilderness. We'll take the next generation in. Now we've run into another hard-hearted people. This people have bounced all the way back to Shinar. Shinar. We first encountered Shinar in Genesis 11. Okay? Tower of Babel in the land of Shinar. And we're back in Babel again. It says, we can keep bouncing back. We're going to end up at my intended destination. I'm going to work with you guys until we get there. But they're going back. So I ask, as history is once again seeming to repeat itself, could it be that God will accomplish through Daniel what he accomplished through Joseph, the saving of many lives? And I wonder what he'll do. Verse 18. Then at the end of days, which the king had specified for presenting them, this was 3 years later, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found to be like Daniel or Hananiah or Mishael or Azariah, the Jewish names, interestingly. So they enter the king's personal service, and for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And we find that Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. So the sovereign God who guided the faithful Joseph into positions of power in Egypt is also the one who is guiding the faithful Daniel and his friends into positions of power in Babylon. And he's going to continue. Daniel's trying to encourage his people. He's going to continue to guide the faithful people who are in exile. He'll continue to guide people today who are faithful. But he's calling Israel to be faithful. He's calling us to be faithful. Even when things don't turn out how we planned, be faithful. You know, even when we find ourselves in a place we didn't mean to be, God's still at the wheel. He's still the conductor. Even when you're suffering through no fault of your own, like Joseph or Daniel, be faithful. Even when that faithfulness can cost you your friends or your finances or your family, God says, be faithful. Now, one thing we have to remember as we continue through this book is that it was written for us, wasn't written about us. It was written for us, it wasn't written about us. And it wasn't really, Daniel is not the hero in the story, right? We're not the hero. Daniel's not the hero. The God that's working in and through Daniel and through this people is going to be the hero in the story. So we notice in chapter 1, Daniel was in Babylon. Verse 2, why? Oh, because God gave Judah over. Or verse 9, Daniel is viewed favorably by the Babylonians. Why? Because God granted him favor. Or Daniel and his friends have these incredible abilities and knowledge and wisdom. Why? Because God gave them the knowledge and their wisdom and their abilities. Daniel's a hero of the faith because he worships the hero of the faith. I think of modern day heroes of the faith. Annie Johnston Flint. Any of you know of her? She was a woman who suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, cancer, incontinence, partial blindness, covered from head to toe with boils and blisters. She was a wonderful hymn writer. Ravi Zacharias speaks of her from time to time. She writes this: He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added afflictions he addeth his mercy, to multiplied trials his multiplied peace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving has only begun. His love has no limits. His grace has no measure. His power no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. And we know in the fullness of time, God gave the gift of His Son to the world, through whom we have redemption.
the forgiveness of our sins. But the question comes down to, do you know him?